Welcome, everybody, to the War College here at 2015 Celesticon. My name is Dana Lombardi. This is the first of two talks I'm going to be giving today. This one is about a series of books that I'm going to be publishing called Napoleon's Last Army, 1815, and I'll get into that in a second. But first, Mark, you've got a question. What is it?
Well, before you started your recording, you were talking about staff work and armies are creatures of bureaucracy that create forms. What, if any, impact do you believe the death of Marshal Berthier had on Napoleon's conduct of the 1815 campaign?
I think it's huge, and I'll get into that in the talk. But one of the most important things that everyone has to understand is, even if you've been trained to do something, but it's your first time doing it, there's a learning curve, right? And Soult, who was a commander in the peninsula for Napoleon's armies, is now going to be his chief of staff. And that means Napoleon's going to say, we got to do this, got to do that. I want this guy to go here. I want these wagons with the ammunition to be here. Somebody has to interpret those orders, write them down clearly, and then have duplicates made, and it has to get out to the right people. So you have to send multiple copies to the people who need that to make sure that they receive it, because, you know, a courier could be killed, captured, lose his way, and so forth. So Soult's doing this for the first time. He's not a stupid guy, but he has never been Napoleon's chief of staff until this campaign. So the natural thing that's going to happen with any human being is, if it's your first time you're doing it, whether you're a baseball coach, right, or you're running a department for a big corporation, in this case he's running an army, well, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to not know to do certain things, right? That Berthier, for example, knew automatically. And he said, this always goes pear-shaped, so I'm going to make sure I get six guys out, couriers, with the letter, with it written out this way, to make sure that that ammunition wagon gets exactly where we need it when Napoleon wants it there. And so things are not going to work out as smoothly, because they can't, with a brand new chief of staff, Soult, for the 1815 campaign, compared to Berthier, who's now dead, who may have been murdered rather than commit suicide. But the bottom line is that that has a huge impact on Napoleon's ability to do things in the French armies, okay? So let me go ahead and start on this. What was really interesting to me, we talked about there are entire areas of history that we don't have a lot of information on in English, because they haven't been translated, they haven't been put in the books. This gentleman was talking about your area of Renaissance history, musket and pike. Even in the Napoleonic Wars, which you think would have been mined to death, people have been in the archives digging this out, it's very selective. We know a lot about the Napoleonic campaigns and about Waterloo in particular, because the British feel that they won it. Yes, they give some grudging credit to, you know, the Prussians and the Anglo-Dutch, the Dutch and Belgians who were part of, and the Brunswickers and all the others who were there. But in general, the British mine their own language archives, and there's nothing surprising about that. That's just natural. I mean, if you want to do something on the Germans in World War II, you have to look at what we captured and what's in our archives. Otherwise, you've got to go to Germany and dig this up, so it makes it difficult. So in the same way, yes, Paris is not that far from England, but the bottom line is, if you're going to read documents in handwritten script, it's going to be easier to do it if you read English, if you're going to do a history on Waterloo. So we get that perspective. That means that the documents that have been sitting in Paris for 200 years have not been looked at. There are a lot of these things that have never, ever been used. And the reason is, when Napoleon loses his last campaign and he's forced into final exile, his army is basically broken up, disbanded. A lot of the officers, you know, have to leave. They're exiled. They're executed. You know, they just all have to go. And no one's worried about preserving these documents except the clerks who do it every day, right? And that stuff goes in, it's in a pile, goes in a box, and the box goes in the archives, and no one's looking at it again for 200 years, because there's no reason to. There's no historians in France saying, oh, let's look at the big last campaign that Napoleon had his ass kicked, right? No one wants to do that. No one wants to say, oh, let's really examine this. The British are interested, but they have no need of those documents, because they've got their own story to tell. So the bottom line is that all this information that's sitting in the French archives has been untouched. Part of the reason is, you also have to know how to look it up. So I'll ask a question here. How do you think the documents of 1815 are kept in the French archives? Anybody?
Still in the boxes?
Still in the boxes, but how would you file them? What would it say, 1815 on it? I mean, would that how you put it in there?
By the date?
No. I made that mistake, and I went to try and find it. And I went to their archives, and I said, what do you have on 1815? And they came out with one box that was like just a few papers. And I thought, wow, I guess they weren't keeping the documents. Let's fast forward. World War II. The United States of America is keeping all the documents that were, every day a clerk is typing up what the 2nd Armored Division did, where they were, how many guys they lost. All this stuff has to be maintained. It's kept in a file, a big binder, that says 2nd Armored Division. That's how you find it. You don't go to 1944 in the archives and find what the 2nd Division's doing. You go to a binder that's the 2nd Division, and you open it to those dates. That's how you do it. Okay, so the French Army, like most armies, keep track of units. Okay, so the 2nd Lancer Regiment, or the 1st Line Infantry Regiment, or the 3rd Artillery Regiment, is where you're going to find those documents. It's kept in a file by that unit. And there's this huge pile, which includes how many guys they've got, how many guys they've lost, whether they're sick, wounded, or missing, right? Officers that were killed, awards that were given, after action reports, and that's all there. I mean, there's the guy who is working on this, Paul Dawson, has, this is just his collection over 20 years, 10,000 documents, pages of documents. Okay, that's not the entire army. That was just done in 1815. Okay, that doesn't include all the Napoleonic 22 years of war. Those are just the units that were at Waterloo specifically. So if you want to know what was at Ligny, if you want to know what was Quatre Bras, if they ended up at Waterloo, then you'll also have those prior dates. Okay, but so all these thousands and thousands of pages in 200 years since the Napoleonic Wars ended have not been used by anybody. So I'm really excited that what we've got is information that no one's ever seen. I'll show you some examples of that in a second. So the series of books is going to be broken down in order to be reasonable size and able to be digested. It's going to be, there's a book on the Guard Cavalry. There's a separate book on the Guard Infantry and Artillery. Then there's a book on the Line Cavalry, Line Artillery and Infantry. Okay, so that's how it's broken down. And then overall, okay, these are nice details and everything, but what does it really mean? And that's where we're going to get into, did Napoleon really have a chance to win this, or is this just a fantasy that there are people that love Napoleon and just are rooting for him even though he had no chance? And I'll show you that not only did he have a really good chance, but there are several what-ifs that could have happened where he could have turned the whole situation into a victory, and I'll show you how that happens. Okay, so, yes?
Are the records at La Ibelaz?
No. They're at the SHAT, which is the... it's in a fort just outside of Paris, which now Paris, of course, is completely surrounded. It's the French Army Archives. That's how it translates into. But it's SHAT in French. And it's all there. From every war, World War I, World War II, you know, the Napoleonic Wars, that's where it all is. And it's in boxes, right? But they're handwritten documents that you have to hold, you wear gloves in order to handle these pieces of paper because they're like 200 years old. And they make copies for you, okay? So they will do that. So anyway, I just mentioned the four books. There they are, the Guard Cavalry, et cetera, et cetera. And that's how they're going to be presented. Keith Rocco is the artist who is famous in America for doing Napoleonic and American Civil War paintings, and he has been doing the imagery for the books so that every major unit, whether it's Lancers or light infantry or whatever it is, there's going to be images, and you'll see some of those in this presentation. So we're putting together, like I said, something that's never been done before, so you'll have the reference book on the French in the 1815 campaign. Okay, so Paul Dawson... although he's British, he's wearing the grenadiers of the horse grenadiers of the guard, grenadiers à cheval. He really takes a lot of flack from his fellow Brits because he studies the French. He's fascinated with them, and he actually, oh my God, you know, dresses up like them and is a reenactor. So they hate him. I mean, there truly are people that like hate this guy. But when I saw that he was doing this, I said, we don't have that problem over here. It's not that we only love the French. It's just like, you know, a lot of Anglophiles in America that love the British because they have ancestry. But we're interested in finding about the whole story, you know, as we want to see what's going on. He's a professional field researcher, archaeologist. He actually went to Hougoumont recently and went through it. As they dug up things, and they discovered there was this huge hedge that you could not go through. And they found that because the roots and everything are still there. You know, they're dead, but they didn't clear those out. They cut the hedges off many years after the battle, but those are still there. So that's one of the things you've learned through archaeology. And he's also a horseman who owns horses and actually has won second place in dressage and some other equestrian events. So he's very knowledgeable of the cavalry and what it can and can't do. Okay, and here's Keith Rocco in his studio. His studio is wonderful. He has both reproduction and actual uniform artifacts from that period. And here's what's interesting is that you would think, you go over there and you look at one of these coats, these French coats, and it's just gorgeous. And I'm sitting there looking at this saying, Keith, how can it possibly be this blue still? It's 200 years old, right? If a guy wore it in the field in just a month, it's going to be totally trashed, right? I mean, look at what happened. He said, yes, that's correct. What happens is, if you have 100,000 guys, you don't make 100,000 uniforms, do you? Roger, how many uniforms did you have in the 101st? How many?
Three.
Yep. And that's just what you had. They still had a bunch in a warehouse so that when those got worn out, they had more, right? What survives from all these really old periods of history is that they have a bureaucracy and a system of logistics. They have uniforms that were never issued. Okay? It's just that simple. There's nothing wrong with them, okay? And they're not different colors because they're the color that the manufacturer made them and shipped them out and put them in packages or whatever. And so the people who collect this stuff, and there was a pair of brothers in France who were most famous for buying up everything they could in the French army from this period because they were rich and they wanted to collect it. So this is where the stuff gets preserved. Their collection was eventually broken up and sold off. So that's how we know what the color of these uniforms are supposed to be when they first come out. After a week in the field, a month in the sun and so forth, forget it, it's done. Whatever the color was is going to be different. But Keith is basically putting this together, and then you also find out other things that some of the people who have done uniform plates that paint these things, and this is what the guy is supposed to look like, okay? All right, in 1815, Napoleon's throwing together this army. He's in Elba, he escapes, he gets to Paris in March, and in June, he's fighting a campaign. So there's not a lot of time to like do anything other than get the army together, grab the guys, you know, get them into some sort of reorganization. So what uniform are the guys going to bring with them?
The one they wore.
That's correct. So even though the regulations say Napoleon the Emperor has ordered that these guys are supposed to wear this kind of piping on their uniform, is there time to make that? Literally, make it, manufacture it, get it done, thousands of these things, deliver it to the guys and have them put it on, right? Very few. So some of the regulations in 1815 that say a unit is supposed to be wearing something, okay, that doesn't mean they were wearing that in the field. So what Keith and Paul did is they looked at, you know, what the documentation is. A few units got new uniforms, okay? But most of them are still wearing the stuff from 1814. So that's important because when Keith's doing this, he's not trying to make these guys look like they're supposed to look according to regulations. This is what they look like in the field in the 1815 campaign. Okay, so what's new? It's like, okay, besides the documentation of the French army, there are 17 paintings, and this is a typical example. There's an actual portrait of this guy. Okay, it actually exists, this young lieutenant. His family, he was upper class, obviously, and he had a portrait. So Keith decided to do Pierre Noël of the Imperial Guard. He was at the Grenadiers of Chaville. He was wounded at Waterloo, and we have that documentation in his left thigh. Okay, that's how he was shot. All that is known, and that is that's the way the guy looked, okay? We've got a portrait of him about that size, and then all that detail is the best information. It may not be true because we don't have photographs, okay? But it's the best information we've got on what these guys looked like in their last campaign. And some of them we have actual portraits to work from for some of the officers. Okay, so here's other things that you don't see. Here's logistics. No one ever looks at that, right? These are the guys in the Imperial Guard, and so the train de equipage, these are the guys that, as you can see, well, what eats more than men?
Horses.
Right, and if you don't feed them, you're not moving wagons, you're not moving artillery, and there are tens of thousands of horses that have to be cared for and fed. So you have wagons full of oats and hay and whatever else they munch on. So, and it takes a lot of guys hauling this stuff. So their job is not shooting at the enemy, it's not doing any of this other, it's just feeding them. And so this is an aspect of, the army and the way it functions that is really important to see. And that has never been depicted in any of these books. Okay, so here's another thing, is that this is a pie chart that shows how the Grenadiers of Chaval were put back together. Remember, Napoleon gets back, he doesn't have a lot of time to throw these units back together, and they're scattered. So that one regiment, this is the elite of the elite, this is the most senior regiment of guard cavalry that he's got. Okay, you figure the best of the best. If you can make something homogeneous, you can make them cohesive, you do that. And yet, look at this pie chart, right? He had to pull guys from all over just to bring it up to strength. Line chasseurs, hussars, line lancers, dragoons, cuirassiers, military workmen. If you can ride a horse really well, oh, guess what? You're in the guard cavalry. Okay? Young guard chasseurs of Chaval, old guard chasseurs of Chaval, the empress dragoons, and we do have some guys from the Grenadiers of Chaval, but they're not the majority. Okay, so after 22 years of campaigning, a lot of these guys are dead, wounded. It's like, no, I did my bit. Sorry, you're on your own on this one, right? Or they're just simply too old, right? And their wives are going, you're going to do what, right? It's like, no. Well, Napoleon can do this one on his own. But look at that in terms of, we'll have the actual percentages, okay, so you can see, but you can get a good idea that the Grenadiers of Chaval, which is probably one of your most elite units, and actually performs really well, okay, even includes some guys who weren't even combat troops in previous campaigns. Okay. Average age, just looking at a variety of light and line troops, the Rhine regiments, you can see that, what do you notice? Is that they're older, right? Okay, in 1813, Napoleon is desperate to raise another big army because he lost one in Russia. So he brought all these young guys up who were advanced. He didn't wait for the class to reach the right age. He grabbed guys who were younger, and these guys were like 16, 17, even 15 years old. They were called the Marie Louises because they hadn't even been able to grow beards yet, so they looked like young women, right? And so he's just throwing these guys into the line, right? And they're getting slaughtered. They're just getting, truly, because they're not trained properly or anything. So in 1815, the French government says, we'll accept you back as the emperor. But, there's several things. Politically, you've got to do this and that and the other. But one of the most important things is you're not taking young, untrained recruits into Belgium. It's not happening. We don't agree with that. So one of the reasons Davout is left back at Paris is to raise these new troops and train them. So he has like 100,000 more guys under training, but they're not up front. That means that your average age is higher because all of these guys had to be veterans. In other words, all he can take into the field in 1815, the reason why people say, this is not a bad army. Yeah, he had to throw it together quickly, but these are all vets. They know the drill. They know how to load and fire their weapons. They know how to stand in line so that even if I don't know the guy next to me, he knows and I know how to do, the different drill required. So it's an older army. Okay, where did this come from? All right. I can't read this. This is so badly written. Paul is in there. Over years, Paul has been able to decipher this. It was all handwritten. There's no typewriters back then, okay? So when they're writing about, like this after-action report, it's in script, in French, and not modern French, okay? So you don't do this fast. So this took years of him to put together. And that, by the way, is one of the sappers of the guard, and it, this document refers to them, what they did. So we've got that, but this takes a lot of work, okay? And so Paul has put together an amazing assortment of documents. And we can't, obviously we didn't put 100,000 pieces of paper into these books, okay? That's not going to happen. So we basically distilled a lot of it into these charts and tables and diagrams. And then we also took the after-action reports from people and we translated those so that you have an idea what they did. Remember, this is their story, the French Army story. Okay. All right. And then this is a typical chart. The only thing printed back then was like this table, which every army would have. You'd have piles of these blank. And so what you're supposed to do is, as a clerk, right? You know all this. You've probably seen a lot of it, right? It's the same stuff back then, except instead of typing it in, you're filling it out by hand. It's like, I won't even try because it's not large enough to be clear. But the bottom line is that it's like each battalion, each company. You know, you get the who's there, who's not, and all this other stuff. By the way, this page goes to it's a double page, and it looks very similar. What's really amazing is that page looks very, very similar to Civil War documents that I've seen, where they talk about a particular regiment of infantry or artillery battery. Okay. Armies do this. In fact, if you didn't know the language and you saw these things, it would look like it's all coming from the same army because they copy each other and it's like, once it works, it works. I suspect that there are tablets in Egyptian, okay, and Hittite that look very similar to this, okay? It's like somebody sat there and said, God damn it. He's writing this stuff down, right? And some guy's sitting there going, damn, I wish I was, you know, why do I get stuck with this weekend, right? But that's what's happening. Here are some Young Guard soldiers. All right, they had the tirailleurs and the voltigeurs, and this group of guys, getting ready for the campaign. And a lot of them did not come from guard units or even line units. They were just thrown together. So the Young Guard is not going to perform as well as the Old Guard. And that's the whole question. It's like, how good was it? Right? That's all right. How good was it? Okay, so remember, Napoleon reaches Paris in March, right? He hasn't done anything yet to get this army, but he knows that all these armies are forming against him. So what does he do? In 8 weeks, think about that, 8 weeks, he assembles 128,000 soldiers for the field, and that improvised army invades Belgium, okay, in 8 weeks. And he does it in a way that he humbugs Wellington. Wellington has no idea that he's pulling this off, right? So Napoleon closes all the borders first. Right, no one in or out, cuts off any intelligence gathering on the part of the enemy and hides what he's doing, where he's gathering his army, and then the words go out, get there. Now, how do they get there? How do you get this information? There's no telegraph. There's no phone. Nobody's got a cell saying report to duty, right? Somebody has to ride there. Somebody has to get to every one of these towns, right? They have semaphore, and they can get the word out there, but it's not everywhere in France. So these guys, as soon as they get it, they have to start getting there. Not everybody has a horse. So there are guys literally walking up into northwest France, or northeast France, near the Belgian border. So a lot of that 8 weeks is just getting the word out to them and them getting to the location. Once they get there, it's like, report to your battalion, report. Again, you know, it's the same sort of thing any modern army does. So despite shortages in horses, equipment, ammunition, and men, okay, what happens? One of the greatest generals in history then defeats a much larger army at Ligny, who's waiting for him, who's already plotted out how they're going to defend this territory. Okay? And then 2 days later, Wellington says that was a near-run thing. We almost lost. Okay? With an improvised army, without enough stuff. This is how close this campaign is, which is why I think it's so exciting. Okay. Well, we backtrack. What was his first campaign like? What did Napoleon do that was unlike anybody else? Because you asked that before. It's a famous general. You don't usually study.
He won all the time. Yeah.
Yes, he won all the time. How did he do that? A couple of reasons. I'll give you the big view on this, okay? Number one is he thought faster and did things faster than his opponents. Their army, somebody mentioned they were studying the Seven Years' War, okay? That was slower paced. And a lot of the guys he was fighting were in their 70s, okay? which means, and I can guarantee that, you know, I'm 65, and when I was 25, I did things a lot faster for a lot longer. It didn't take me long to recover. But after a hard day of riding and everything, a 75-year-old guy is going to say, I'm going to bed, wake me in the morning. And Napoleon's still up all night working with his marshals, his generals, to get things organized. And another thing is that these guys on the Austrian side in Italy, they have guys to do that. They're not going to micromanage. They're going to send out the orders, and it will get done at a precise pace, right? Carefully. Napoleon is right there, okay? If you are not, you do not want to be a guy that says, look busy, okay? Napoleon's going to come in the middle of the night, and he's going to say, why aren't you doing what you're supposed to do with your division? He accosts the generals right on the spot. It's like, either you're going to do this, or I'll fire you, and I'll get somebody else who's going to do it. Keep in mind, he's 26 years old, and he's going up against generals in the French army who are in their 30s and a few of them in their 40s. They've been around the block more than he has. Some of them have actually lived longer than Napoleon, right? They know how things work. They're more interested in looting, you know, drinking, wine, women, the whole nine yards. And this upstart, this young, you know, young guy comes in here and says, no, we're not going to do it that way. This is the way we're going to do it. And he succeeds. And he's an artillery officer, right? So they can't BS him. I mean, literally, they can't say, well, you know, what kind of combat have you been in? He says, well, I had a bayonet when I've been that close to the enemy, okay? So I know what I'm talking about, and we're going to do this way. And if you disagree, then the government of France, the revolutionary government, is the one who appointed me. So why don't you complain to them? It's like, oh, okay, yes or no, sir, okay? It's just real simple. So what does he do? There are two armies that he's facing, okay, in Italy. And what's the first thing he recognizes? I'm going to get between them. I'm going to go absolutely between these two so that I can deal with each one separately. And you would think, well, yeah, that's been used for many years. It's been used for centuries since then. But it wasn't used back then. This is a new concept. Somebody had to come up with this. So one of the first things he did is, I don't have an army big enough. It's not well enough equipped. I mean, one of the things he said about his army in Italy is, you're naked, you're starving, you know, you don't have anything, they're not paying you. Now I want you to go out and die for me. So the interesting thing is that he was able to say that to the guys and make them fight for him. Because all the generals before that, and the French soldiers knew that nothing's going to happen. He convinced them. This 26-year-old convinced them that it was going to all be different. So absolutely. He says, you beat these guys, loot the town, I don't care. Pillage. It's the right of the soldier. And they're going, okay. The government's not going to pay me. I think I'll take it out somewhere else. And he got everyone to believe him, because as he's doing this, as you can see, the blue arrows of the French are going between the two armies, and he's going to crush this one and then turn on the other one, who's going to beat feet as fast as it can. They can never seem to get organized. He won't let them. His pursuit is one of the most important things, which is the next aspect. Is that usually you defeat each other, you know, you sit there, you know, take care of your wounded, you know, you get reorganized, because even a winner gets disorganized in the fact of winning. No. It's like, we're not stopping. Whoever is the most organized, get out there on the road right now, whatever cavalry got, and he doesn't have much, by the way, in Italy, very little cavalry. All of a sudden, he's pursuing them aggressively, and they just can't get organized. He won't let them do that. Their rear guard gets hammered, and the rest of the army has to keep going and going. Finally, when they're almost to Mantua and Venice, is when they finally outrun the French, who are pursuing them that close. That is going to be the formula that he uses over and over again. And because people are not talking to each other, the Austrians, who have the crap kicked out of them, okay, they just get fired. So they're not talking to them. They're not telling the Prussians. They're not telling the Russians, right? They're not telling, in fact, in the Austrian army, they're not telling the Austrians. Why? Because you lost. Why should I listen to you? Right? I said, no, you should really. This guy is doing something totally different. It's like, what happens? Yeah. It's like, well, that's not going to happen to me. You're just an idiot, right? I'm not going to pay attention. You're not going to tell me how to fight this young kid, right? That's another reason why he's able to keep doing that. And then what happens is this. You achieve, I'm going to call it, a moral supremacy over other people, okay? It's basically psychological. You achieve having an advantage because they can't believe that the army is not somehow mystically led by this genius, right? Well, Napoleon, really, by our standards, is not a genius, but compared to what he's fighting, he's a genius, okay? Compared to what he's up against. He's fighting old generals who use an old school style of fighting, and he's got a new way of doing it, okay? Here's the best way I can say this. Imagine that the Dallas Cowboys, okay, with only half the guys, are fighting the best high school team in America, and they get to field like 22 guys instead of 11 on the field, okay? 22 against 8. Who's going to win? I don't think there's any doubt, right? There's no doubt. It doesn't matter. If you're not betting on the Dallas Cowboys, you know, you're going to lose, okay? And that's what I'm trying to show, is that the difference psychologically, because the first thing that happens is when the high schoolers step onto the field, what do? They go, oh my God, this guy's like a foot taller than me, right? He weighs at least 50, 75 pounds. He's going to kill me. So what do? It's like, I'm just going to wait and see what he does. So even though you outnumber them, you're not going to be aggressive. And that's what happens, is that every time he wins, and he wins again, and he wins again, by the time he gets to Waterloo, even Wellington says, Napoleon on the field is worth 40,000 troops. It's like a whole corps, you know? Even if we outnumber the French, and they knew they did, it's like, we have to be really careful, because that's Napoleon. That psychological advantage is so huge that it carries him almost up until 1815. And it starts back here in 1796. Okay, so there's a controversy about Wellington. I mentioned it earlier that Wellington says that Napoleon humbugged him. In other words, Napoleon got a jump on him because Napoleon suddenly ends up in Belgium at a time they didn't expect, sooner than they didn't expect. Because everyone knows it takes months to assemble an army. I mean, it took us months to put their Anglo-Allied army together, and the Prussians and everybody else, and we're out there just, you know, having balls and whatever else we do. And yes, go ahead.
So, wasn't the army that was in Belgium, they didn't learn anything over the past 20 years about Napoleon?
Well, okay, they know that he's really good, but they don't really understand why, because their armies don't operate that way. They're run by a class system where people of the nobility, people who are royally, you know, appointed or are part of the really high upper class, that's why you become a general. It has nothing to do with your ability at all. Whereas Napoleon's army has this expression that every soldier has the marshal's baton in his knapsack. It wasn't totally true, but Ney, for example, is a good one, who started off as a private in the cavalry. Okay? Guy goes from private to marshal of France, directing entire armies. Okay? He wasn't probably the most brilliant guy in the world, but you could get that high. That never happened in the other armies. It doesn't. Unless you have nobility, unless you are, I mean, if you're just a middle class person, you'll get up to a certain rank level. You could be maybe a chief of staff, a colonel or something, but there's no way you're not going to be a general or a field marshal or anything at that level. That didn't happen. Because what was Napoleon? Minor nobility, right? And the only reason noble is because the King of France made his dad a noble of Corsica when they took it over. He wasn't really born into nobility. So he gets to the schools in France where his father's able to wrangle him an appointment, better schools, right? There's no schools in Corsica. So he sends him there, can barely speak French, and what do all the young aristocrats do? Nyeh, 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 right? They make fun of him. Say, you have no money, you have no class, and your nobility is a joke, your title is, you know, made up, you know, you're pathetic. So Napoleon, of course, resents this, but he can't really do anything about it other than become a tough young kid who organizes the snowball fights, becomes a leader, you know, rather than a follower. And what does he do? He reads. He reads constantly. He reads as much as he can. By the time he gets into the second level of academia, basically, what we'd say, you know, prep school, right? He is reading. That's all he can do. He has no money. Okay, so as these other young aristocrats he grew up with in these schools, what are they doing? Well, they're gambling, right? They're going out with women. They're drinking, right? Because they can afford to do so. That's what they want to spend their time and money on. So what does Napoleon do? Reads, reads, reads. And so one of France's greatest military minds at the time takes a look at this young kid and says, you know what? I'm going to take him under my wing and I'm going to teach him, you know, and basically tutor him. And that's what he does. So Napoleon is able to get the kind of direction for a young officer or a young cadet that, you know, usually don't get. The same sort of thing, by the way, happens with Dwight Eisenhower. Dwight Eisenhower is taken under the wing of Fox Connor, who's a general, when Dwight is just like a young lieutenant. Fox Connor is in the Panama garrison, out in the middle of nowhere. So Eisenhower is transferred there, and Fox Connor has him bring a bunch of books, and he has his own library, and he says, you're going to study and read all this. There's nothing else to do here. We're protecting a canal that no one's going to attack. So that's what we're going to spend our time in. After that, Eisenhower goes to the Army War College in Leavenworth, thank you. Leavenworth. So he goes there and he becomes one of the best young officers. High marks. And they mark this kid. He is going to go far because he's bright, he studies, and, you know, he's a thinker. That's what happened with Napoleon. They identified him as among all these young aristocrats who just, you know, can't be bothered. Because they're going to have land, property, they're going to become officers anyway, because they're entitled. Napoleon's got to fight for all this stuff, which is another reason why he not only, unusually for the period, without the French Revolution, that opportunity would never happen, but he's also very much pro other guys who fight their way up by a meritocracy, where if you prove yourself to be, you know, willing to work, you're lucky, and you're willing to think, then you're going to get a chance to get a higher rank. And that's what he does. Anyway, so Wellington and his army, as you can see, are spread out all over Belgium. And the reason for that is you don't want to make the people locally angry with you. Okay? So what do? You spread out your army so no one has too much of a burden. Because who's feeding you? Who's feeding your horses? The locals, right? If you strip them and leave them with nothing, they're not happy with you and they're not going to cooperate. Okay? The Prussians are not spread out. They don't care what anybody. The Germans have this problem, I guess. They just don't care how, you know, diplomatically, they're just not too good. But they're gathering. As soon as Napoleon's army arrives across the in Belgium, they're starting to gather for the fight at Ligny, and Wellington is all spread out. When he finds us out, he can only gather his troops so quickly. So the controversy is this. Wellington was supposed to cooperate with the Prussians, but he can't because his army is too spread out. So what would you do if you're an officer who's been caught out in a very bad, embarrassing situation and you can't help the guys you promised you're going to come to? Oh, sorry. What do? You lie to them, of course.
Could you ask that again? Ask the same thing.
So I promised I'm going to come with my army. We're absolutely going to support you. When you were going to fight Napoleon, we'll be there on your right, okay? My troops will be ready, totally support you, come to your aid if you need it, okay? Bye, I'll talk to you tomorrow, okay? So, some people have said, why did he say that to the Prussians when he actually couldn't do it? He couldn't do it. He couldn't do it because he's all spread out. So they were looking at evil intent. I think it's human nature. Okay, I think that he is just in a bad situation. He doesn't want to tell the Prussians because if he tells them that, what would you do? You're going to fight Napoleon all by yourself. What I'm saying is you're going to fight him almost completely on your own, right? And I can't help you at all. Good luck, right? So he didn't say that. Yes, you may have your ass handed to you, okay, which is going to happen, but it looks like I'm trying to support you as your ally. That's the problem when you've got people that don't speak the same language, who are allies, who have different agendas, okay? And Napoleon is exploiting that because where is he getting, again, remember the scene in Italy? He's getting between the two armies, right? So he can deal with one and the other without having to worry about both of them, ganging up on him. Okay, yes?
Small, sorry, question. Did he, at the same time, was he using some type of propaganda or something against having sending guys out to just...
Oh, you mean like disinformation?
Yes, or...
Part of the problem with trying to do things like that is, will it reach the right people? I mean, yeah, you could send out false documents and deliberately have somebody captured. I mean, one of the most famous incidents in World War II is where they took a dead body, threw him out of a submarine, basically, right, with these documents on him. He washed up on the shore of France that showed that the Allies were going to attack Pas-de-Calais. And the Germans got this information, which made them think that, you know, the invasion was going to come right there across the channel at the Narrows Point, not Normandy, okay? So that's a perfect example of this kind of misinformation. But I really don't think you could pull that off back then, because it assumes this one document is somehow going to finally wind its way all the way up to Wellington and Blücher fast enough to influence their decision-making. You see?
Okay,
you had a question.
I think the Vincent you were talking to was actually they come to the party on Spain.
And I'm sorry, yes, Spain.
They were trying to get right. To believe they were attacking Sardinia instead of Sicily.
Oh, right, okay. Yes, that's right. It was in the Mediterranean. I'm sorry, I got the wrong place. But basically, it's the same thing. They're trying to make the Germans think they were going to attack someplace else. And they had time to do that.
And they had to, first of all, they had to believe that the Spanish would actually turn it over to the Germans, which they did.
Right, right. So there's so many moving parts of this that it could have gone nowhere. And it's really difficult because somebody at a very low level has to look at this document and realize that it's important enough to go that high up. Then you have to wonder, why has this guy got a document that important? Okay? Which makes it suspicious immediately. I just don't think that they were doing anything. Remember, his timing was faster than anybody else anyway. if he planted false information, and by the time they looked at it, and by the time they did anything, he's already on to step three. Right? So he can't use it.
Is it true, I read that here, there was an account that he would sometimes play chess with eight guys at the same time?
No, that's...
Is that five guys?
No.
None of that's true?
No. No, what he would do is this. I actually have a set of the little, it's like little toy soldiers that he had, and he had calipers. He laid down on maps. He had maps laid out, and he would put things down to represent different divisions or corps or whatever, and he had these calipers. So when he was calculating whether he could pull off something, he measured it. He didn't just guess that, oh, this corps is going to reach the battlefield. No. He knew that there's no way that corps is going to get there in 8 hours. Just can't, okay? So that influenced his scientific approach to the battles, okay? And so he would then figure out how he wanted to converge the different units, divisions, and corps at a location. Often, he would win the battle. There's still a big battle to be fought, but he made sure that he had the elements at that battle enough to win almost every engagement he was into. Another reason why, you were asking, why did this guy keep winning all the time? It's because his preparation was that intense. And it wasn't just the guys with the guns, it was also those guys hauling the hay. I mean, you have to have the logistics to keep, you know, maintaining forces and to get them there and sustain them. Okay, so Napoleon gets between the Prussians over here. Let me use this. Prussians are over here at Ligny. There's Blücher. And then you can see that the stuff is trying to get there as fast as it can from the Anglo-Allied Army of Wellington. And what Napoleon wants to do is he just wants Ney to hold this so that they can't reinforce Blücher. And then the first corps is supposed to come over, one more corps, which is all marching to the battlefield. This is another amazing thing. This is, you can't see this, but this is a rise. This is like the top of a hill. So I'm looking down, and I can see the French approaching. I can see this. It's like, okay, I can count how many they've got and everything. I see what they've got. This is not a big surprise. This is not like, you know, smoke screens or anything like that. So they can see that Napoleon has army forces approaching. They can't see through the forest here to what's happening over here, but they can hear it, they can see smoke of battle, but they can see what's in front of them. And so what goes haywire for the French army, but I'll go down the list here, you can see that the Dutch-Belgian division that is here, actually Wellington wants it to move over here because he believes, Wellington, I don't know why he believed this, but he thought that Napoleon was going to try and come this way rather than between the two armies. Somebody asked, how did they not talk to each other about this? Well, they never did. They just simply didn't have that as part of their way of thinking. Yes, they're wearing uniforms, but they're not military professionals like we have today. There's none of this war college stuff. If I'm the count of whatever, and I also happen to be a general, why would I listen to you know, you from another country? It's like, how dare you, you know, suggest that I am wrong, right? So he would never insult me at the dinner table. So Napoleon obviously isn't coming this way. He's going between the two armies. So Perponcker, his Dutch-Belgian division, is sitting here at Quatre Bras. The only thing they have. There's no British troops up there. Remember, they're all over the place. So he gets these orders from Wellington saying, I want you to move from here and go here. All right? Now, this is really important. So that's my direct order to you as my subordinate. So what does this guy do? This Dutch-Belgian officer who has this division is standing there looking at night. What does he see? What's the one thing that armies have back then?
Fire.
That's right. So if you see like 3,000 little fires out there, it probably means there's a lot of guys on the other side, right? Happened during the American Civil War. That's how you can often tell. Where are they, right? Just count the fires at night. If there's no fire over there, they don't have any troops over there. Because the first thing troops do is they build a fire. Okay, so Perponker is sitting there going, you know, I just don't feel comfortable leaving this spot. We're the only troops on the Allied side, and I see, like, too many fires in front of us. So what does he do? He disobeys Wellington's order, and he stays there. Now, what happens, of course, is the French are there. They attack the next day. Perponker holds out long enough for the British to get there, okay? So everything's fine and forgiven. But what if he was wrong? What if there was a bigger force of French coming up this way and Wellington knew that? He doesn't know that. So this guy put his career on the line by disobeying that order. He never gets credit for this, by the way. It's never talked about because Wellington also looks bad because he guessed wrong. He basically has decided it's coming somewhere else. So all that gets covered up. But that is a huge decision in this campaign. Okay? And then at Quatre Bras, Wellington had only a portion of his army. 3/8 of his infantry, only 1/3 of his artillery, and only 1/7 of his cavalry. Why? Remember, it's spread out all over the place, right? It can't get there fast enough. So even though he's got like 70,000 guys, it's just a small portion, okay? And at Ligny, Blücher is missing one of his four corps. Now, they had practiced this. They've been there. All the corps commanders are there at Ligny. So this is where I want you when we know that Napoleon is marching on us. And when if he comes against us, this is where I want you. An entire corps is not there after rehearsing this stuff, right? Clausewitz, who was a colonel in this campaign, he was a young colonel in the 1815 campaign, he, of course, goes on to write the famous On War, Philosophy of Warfare. Clausewitz is quoted many, many times. He says, one of the most famous quotes is, the friction of war you have to deal with. And the friction meaning that stuff just happens, it goes pear-shaped for whatever reason that you can't even plan for. So one entire corps of the Prussian army doesn't make it to the field of battle. One entire corps of Napoleon's force doesn't make it to the battle, okay? Even though he told them, get there. Ney says, no, 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 I need you over here. So he marches that way, and Napoleon says, why are you going that way? He sends the guy out, bring him back. By the time they get here, he's already defeated this army. He could have defeated it a lot worse by having those extra troops. But one entire corps is going march, 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 back and forth. Okay, so let's take a look at Napoleon's, one of his most famous, if not his famous victory, the one big one that he did when he was emperor. He became emperor in 1804. Austerlitz was his first big one, okay? And if you compare, all the blue is Austerlitz and red is in 1815. Napoleon has more cannon, a lot more cannon, okay? Like 90 more guns, smaller army. He has, what? More cavalry than he did in 1805. The only thing he doesn't have more of is infantry, okay? So what does this tell us over 22 years or 10 years of warfare? One is that he, as an artilleryman, and after fighting the Russians and everybody else, firepower. We know that firepower is going to be enormously more effective in World War I. We know in World War II and today, right? Smart bomb, one building, done, right? Back then, more guns, more chance of victory. Cavalry, even though he's an artilleryman, what does he like to do? What do we remember? Pursuit. What do you use to chase down guys who are trying to get organized? Yeah. Cavalry. There you go. Right. So he is going to use that in this campaign. So what he's got at Waterloo is not much different than one of his most famous victories. So when you come back to this question, did he really have a chance to win the Waterloo campaign? It's like, hello, he's already done this 10 years before. In fact, he's done it multiple times. Okay. Look at the difference here in terms of the guard. Very small amount of guard, Imperial Guard, that was at the time, it's more his bodyguard than anything else. But what he turned it into is like his Rangers, Delta Force, paratroopers, you know, whatever you want to call it. He decided that those guys are going to be my shock troops, okay? It's going to work really well at the Battle of Eylau in 1807 when the Russian grenadiers break through the French lines, break into Eylau. The only guys to stop them are the French infantry of the Guard, and they do it. They not only stop the Russians, who they are outnumbered by, but they turn around and chase them out of the town, okay? These guys are the elite of the elite. And so the Guard infantry and Guard cavalry are a much bigger percentage of the French army by 1815. So the strategic situation, if we step back just for a second, is when Napoleon gets to Paris, okay, the Spaniards are rallied against him. There's royalist support inside of France that's rebelling against the Napoleon's new government. Italy has several armies under the Austrians. There's a big Austrian army headed into getting assembled and going to head into France. Huge Russian army coming, but it's far away and it's going to take time to get there. And then you have Blücher's army, the Prussians, and you've got Wellington's army. They're much closer. So what does Napoleon do? He's going to go get them first. He's going to beat them up, knock them both out, and then have to deal with these guys, hopefully giving Davout time to assemble a trained new force for his army to use to oppose them. And a lot of people say, backing up again, there's no way Napoleon can win this. It's pointless. Even if he wins this campaign in Belgium, it's like, so what? He's got these huge armies coming against him. A couple things happen that you don't usually hear about. Down here, under the French command is under the command of Suchet, one of his marshals in the peninsula. You don't usually hear about Suchet because he didn't fight Wellington in the peninsula. What he did is totally pacify southern Spain. He beat every British unit and every Spanish unit in the south of Spain. Never lost. Okay, so Napoleon sends him here and says, deal with this. And what does he do? One battle, he makes them sign a truce. All these guys are knocked out. Why? Austria is just not too keen on this. Who is Napoleon's wife at this time? Anybody? Maria Louisa. Who is?
The daughter of the emperor.
The daughter of the Austrian emperor. She's Austrian. And she is the Empress of France. Her children, she has a son, is going to be the next emperor of France. So there are people in Austria going, why are we fighting this?
March slowly.
Yes, March. Very good. And every opportunity you have, let's do a truce. So this big army here is, we'll get there eventually. The only one that is absolutely hateful of Napoleon, who's the Antichrist, is Alexander's army, because he's determined to get rid of this guy, right? I mean, I have serfs who are my slaves, right? I'm the biggest autocrat in Europe. I'm opposed to everything the French Revolution stands for, and Napoleon has just got to be stopped. Okay, so he's definitely going to fight. But if we can get rid of these guys, I think that it's already been shown that they're willing to not fight if given an opportunity. So this is a much weaker coalition than shows just in paper numbers. I mentioned this before, and I brushed over it. Why did Napoleon have a chance at Waterloo? And that's because 2 days before that, he won a victory at Ligny. And you think, okay, he won, but he didn't, like, crush the army. He never crushed any army completely. It was the pursuit that really made the difference. He just never gave him a chance to get reorganized. But what's unique about Ligny is the fact that, look at what he's fighting. Napoleon only has 56,000 infantry. Again, his whole army at Ligny is 56,000 guys versus almost 80,000, okay? The Prussians have 40% more men at Ligny, and they lose. That's without their one corps, by the way, and without Napoleon getting his corps. Okay, so he wins a battle where he's badly outnumbered. How much is Napoleon worth? What did Wellington say? 40,000. So if you add that, it's like, woohoo, we're up here. So the French, right, they outnumbered him. Okay, so that's how that can be looked at. And if you look at the actual infantry, it's even worse. Because the Prussians have lots of infantry, lots, 69,000 against 44,000 French. But what has Napoleon figured out? Infantry is important, yes, but what does the killing Cannons. Artillery. Cannons. What makes sure the other side cannot get organized?
Cannons.
That's right. Which is what we're going to see. Okay. Napoleon has only 210 guns versus 216 at Ligny. So you wonder, well, he doesn't have a big advantage, right? Yes, he does, because what are the Prussians doing with their guns? Are they deployed?
Yeah.
No, they're waiting to see what Napoleon's going to do. Then after we see what they're going to do, then we're going to deploy our cannon. What's the problem with that? By the time something goes pear-shaped, how can you make sure you're going to get all those guns where you need them? Whereas Napoleon has the initiative. He marches up and he says, I want all the guns over here on the left. That's it, right now. So he gets local superiority in terms of number of artillery pieces, and he also, this is very important, it's not just how many tubes you have, in a modern technology word you could use. It's not how many tubes of artillery, it's how many rounds of artillery do you have. Napoleon made sure that every one of those guns had 1,500 rounds. Okay, it's huge, right? The Prussians have maybe 150. It's like, that's a big difference, right? How long you can sustain an artillery bombardment, how long you're going to be able to stay in action before you're out of ammo and you have to pull back. So there's a built-in weakness to this. And then, of course, the opposing cavalry, the French have more. But there's an advantage here that you just don't see. I don't know how many of you read accounts of the peninsula and how the British, they always were comparing themselves against the French. And the one thing that Wellington kept saying, because he was really not happy with his cavalry, okay, he didn't have control of it as much as Napoleon had control of his forces, because there was a separate cavalry general, and remember, they're all high-level nobility, right? And so the guys, the cavalry general, is like, you can't tell me what to do, you know? I outrank you as a gentleman, right? It's like, okay, whatever. So the British cavalry never performs as well, and Wellington even comments about this several times, that French cavalry, when Napoleon first gets it, is in terrible shape. Badly kept horses, not well trained men, you know, because all of the cavalrymen usually had been young nobles, part of the nobility, part of the aristocracy, and what happened to them during the revolution? Boom, they're gone, okay? So it just leaves guys like Ney who are like, woohoo, I can ride a horse, okay? Well, it takes years to be able to do that. Napoleon instituted a training program that wasn't just, you know, can you ride a horse? It's also about rallying your troops. Not getting your horses totally blown where they only have one charge and they're done, okay? It's not the charge of the light brigade. You always see these guys galloping like crazy. It's like, no. These guys are walking or trotting into battle, okay? It's like, believe me, when you see a wall of cavalry coming at you, they don't have to be galloping to scare the crap out of you. Ann and I watched a movie called The Horseman on the Roof. I don't know if you've ever heard about this movie. It was set in the Third Empire. Not Napoleon's, but with his nephew, Emperor Napoleon III, who is trying to take over Italy. And there's this young couple, and they're on the road, bright day, not a cloud in the sky, and you hear this thunder. I mean, and we're in the theater, and it's like shaking. This theater is shaking, right? And all of a sudden, they get off the road because they're like, oh my God. And this regiment, it's only a regiment, of French cavalry go by. And it's just pounding. It's just amazing. It's scary how loud it is, okay? There's a psychological impact to cavalry that just makes weak people, like, that's it, throw away your weapon and just run as fast as you can. And so the French cavalry is trained and organized in a way that's different. The French cavalry are in basically homogeneous corps, an entire corps of cavalry with several divisions, with brigades and regiments, and the regiments are of the same type. So you have regiments of heavy cavalry, you have regiments of light cavalry, you have regiments of lancers, and he keeps them together. That's just a simple little organizational fact, okay? But it makes it very powerful when you use these troops together, because they have a, as they call it in modern technology today, force multiplier, okay? When you add several different elements together, like artillery and air power and so forth, they become force multipliers with the guys on the ground. In this case, when you add more heavy cavalry to a unit and to a charge in several lines, they become a force multiplier that an individual regiment by itself cannot have that same impact. The Prussians don't have any cavalry corps. The Prussians do not have cavalry divisions. These are all regiments spread out among the corps and around the infantry. So there's never going to have that kind of massive impact that a big cavalry charge can have. Yeah, they're going to make people stop. They're going to make people form a square. But once that regiment is basically blown its forces and ridden off, you can get back to business. Okay. When the French do this, and the reason the cavalry charges at Waterloo are such a big deal is that it doesn't stop. They're just going like in cycles where, you know, one regiment after another, one brigade after another goes through, and you can't move, you can't do anything, okay? So this is not just a number of, like, see, 3,000 more cavalrymen, okay? The way they're organized makes a huge difference, which, again, despite the fact that the Prussians have 40% more troops total, Napoleon has a better organized army, better morale, and he's in charge of it. He personally commands at Ligny.
Question.
Yes?
Going back to the artillery issue, what was the quality of the French artillery, both mechanically and also the training of the artillery?
Okay, so
compared to the
in year 11, which was 1809, they reorganized their artillery, and they just go to basically three types. Six-pounder gun is their standard weapon, and they have a 5.5-inch howitzer, which fires, you know, exploding shell and so forth. And then the guard have 12-pounders. So you have heavy artillery, and you've got all the other guns, okay, as opposed to like a dozen different type sizes of guns. Very well organized, mostly new barrels made, okay, in that time period, because it's over years of the Napoleonic Wars. And so mechanically, metallurgically, it wasn't as good as, say, the American Civil War artillery was, okay? And they're not firing shells. They're firing solid, except for the howitzers. Most of them are firing solid balls, okay? So what you want to do is be able to skip those in troops, which means if your cavalry can make guys stop, form into a nice bunch square, okay, and now you fire these balls through them, it's like bowling. Okay, and remember back then, my artillery has a longer range than your musket, so we can stand there going, you know, 200 yards away, and you're not going to hit me with anything, right? So you're not going to waste your shot. Whereas my artillery is like, okay, well, it's like, can I hit that? Well, try another shot, you know, just, and they're standing there, so you're able to do a lot of damage. Again, the training. Remember, where did Napoleon come from? The artillery. He was personally involved in all of this reorganization of the artillery. He was personally involved in choosing artillery officers. And if you did not measure up, you're not going to be an artillery officer. You're certainly not going to command. Okay. So if we just look at the statistics of the two armies, we've got 50, almost 57,000 French against almost 80,000 Prussians at Ligny. Okay. The advantage almost everywhere except in... The cavalry is in the favor of the Prussians. Now, basically, another way to look at it is the 40% advantage of the Prussians. You could also say that the French army was only 71% the size of the Prussians. Okay, but they never make, except for local counterattacks. There's no major counterattack. They never try to get on the flank. They outnumber them. They have like thousands of guys. They could have just gone around their flank. They don't move. It's like they're frozen. Remember I talked about this other guy is so good. We have to be careful. It's more important to be careful because if we make a mistake, he is going to hammer us. That's how much they feared Napoleon. And in fact, one of the sayings of Napoleon was, never interrupt your opponent when he's making a mistake. So it's like, let's wait for them to do something stupid and then let's jump on them. Okay, and so what's the natural thing to do? If you're not sharing information at one with each other, you're going to be very cautious. You want to be careful. I can't lose this army, so let's make sure that we get defeated, but we don't lose the army. Okay, so that's what's going to happen. All right, and here's what happens is that there's Ligny, there's a bunch of little towns here. They're all deployed here, and the last attack, there's the Imperial Guard, here's the cavalry commands. If you notice, this entire corps over here is just being chased by a division. There's nothing over here. They can see this. There's nothing in front of you. Why are you standing here? It's because I haven't been given orders. I'm not going to do anything without orders, right? Whereas Napoleon would fire you if you didn't show initiative. Okay, this is a big difference, huge difference. So if you're a corps commander in the French army and there's nobody in front of you and you don't have brains enough to just go, I'm going to take advantage of this. You're not going to be a corps commander for very long in the French army. Whereas this guy, Well, first of all, he's a noble, so he's never going to lose his command. He's never going to not be a field marshal, right? So, okay. We stood there, the army lost, and we retreated. That's it. While he's watching the rest of his army get hammered by Napoleon concentrating his smaller army against the other two-thirds of the Prussian army. Okay, so here's the summary. This is really important. Remember these times. I'll bring them up again. The French first attack doesn't even start until 3 o'clock at Ligny. He wins this battle. When did it start at Waterloo? 1 o'clock. So this started later. Could he win at Waterloo? Well, he started earlier. This one doesn't start until 3. Okay? Entire French battalions are used as skirmishers. What does that mean? It means that the guys who stand shoulder to shoulder are suddenly scattered into loose groups just in front of their army, right? Entire battalions scattered out there. What are they doing? Well, the first thing they're doing is picking off officers on the other side. Why? What are you going to do? If you're a private, you're not going to do anything unless somebody tells you to do it. But if the guys who are supposed to tell you that are dead or wounded, no one's going to tell you to do anything, right? So one of the jobs of the French skirmishers is to basically pick off as many of these guys as they can. And we know that there will be high-level officers on Picton, for example, is going to be killed, Uxbridge, blah, 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 okay, all these guys. There's a reason why these officers are going to get killed and wounded at Waterloo, okay, on a level that they've never, ever had happen. Same thing happened at Borodino. Huge numbers of officers, including Bagration, okay, is going to get killed, okay, and that's what's happening. These guys are out there picking off as many officers to basically disrupt the cohesion of the enemy forces, all right? Both sides make frontal attacks in a seesaw battle, but Napoleon's fine with that because he hasn't laid the hammer down yet, okay? It's like back and forth, that's fine. Once they're tired, we'll do something. Okay, but an hour later, the French have most of Ligny, okay? By 5 o'clock, 2 hours, and basically now the main city or town next to Ligny falls. And now they enfilade, which they fire in the flank of the Prussians at Ligny. At 6 o'clock, the last counterattack the Prussians do to retake Ligny fails, and that's it. It's done. But I want to show you something. It's not that the Prussians are not brave. It's not that these guys are cowards, okay? One Prussian regiment stages six separate assaults against one portion of the village. Now, there's two things wrong with this. The first is, why are you making six assaults on the same thing? What was Albert Einstein's definition of insanity? If you keep doing the same thing over and over again, hoping for a new result, a different result, you're crazy. It's like you should have believed the first time. It's not going to work. Okay?
If only following the books.
Yes. So these guys, you know, I'll cut them one or two assaults, but after that, it's like, find a new way. That's what you would have done in the French army, right? If you're a colonel of a regiment or something, and you're doing this, believe me, you're not getting promoted in the French army if you're attacking something the same way six times straight, okay? Figure out another way. Yes?
Could that have something with the leaders being aristocrats and not holding their
regiment? Absolutely.
They're
throwaways, right? Napoleon was loved by his troops. You know, even with the disaster in Russia and everything else, he's worshipped long after, you know, by anyone, even after his death, who served with that army. And people just don't get that because no one loved Alexander the Tsar, okay? It's like, okay, whatever, he's our Tsar, but you know, you had to love the Tsar. Okay, and by 9 p.m., because remember, it's summer, it's June, it's growing dark and the battle's winding down. So the pursuit can only go for so long, all right? But again, I want you to note that it doesn't even start till 3 o'clock, okay? So could Napoleon win at Waterloo? Why not? 2 days before, he won against a bigger force in less time, right? So why did Waterloo end up with him losing? Okay, so the night before Waterloo, the Prussians have gone crazy trying to get away from this, and they're regrouping around Wavre, including the corps that didn't get to Ligny, okay? And Grouchy is supposed to be chasing them, but what's the problem here? It's like, Grouchy, this is the first time he's a marshal, the first time he's in command of a wing, entire wing, and Napoleon said, I need you to pursue these guys and make sure that they don't you know, come to and join Wellington. But what did I say earlier when I was answering your question about Sewell was the first time he was chief of staff? Grouchy's the first time he's going to be this high of command, right? Now, you could say the Peter Principle is involved. And if you don't know the Peter Principle, it says that you're going to be promoted, like in a corporation, up to the level of your incompetence, okay? Because you're obviously competent at whatever level you get the promotion from, right? But you keep going until you hit the level where you're out of your depth, okay? And at that point, you're struggling just to stay there, okay? So the Peter Principle says that Grouchy should have stayed as just a corps commander, okay, instead of a wing commander where he's got multiple corps to, and that a lot of the blame of the battle's loss is going to be on him because his pursuit is pretty weak, okay, and it allows the Prussians to get reorganized. Yes, sir?
I read somewhere that it was partly due to the natural thought that if the right Prussians are defeated, they're going to go back towards Prussia.
This is huge because the supplies went back to Liège, okay, yeah. And there was another, I can't remember the town, but all of their supplies and their communications line are over here. It's not this way. So what Blücher is doing by marching this direction with most of his army to go to the aid of Wellington is he is putting the one corps left behind to hold all this communication line and supply lines, right? Because what happens if Napoleon wins? Okay, which is a possibility. And then you lose the connection behind where you can't get more ammunition, you can't get more food, people don't even know what happened to you. It's like the Prussian army just sort of disappeared. It's like, I hope we hear from it sometime, right? This is huge, it's unprecedented, and in fact, Blücher's chief of staff and his commanders are going, don't do this! This is a bad thing. We don't know what we're marching into. We just know this guy just kicked the crap out of us, right? And it's like, we need to protect our army because we can join up with Tsar Alexander, right? We can fight Napoleon, but why are you risking this? And Blücher's answer is, I promised Wellington I'd be there. That's it. He has other issues too, but you know, he's also, what's really wonderful is that, you know, life is not fair. So Blücher risks his entire army. He's the reason that Wellington is going to win the Battle of Waterloo, because when his troops show up, Napoleon's going to be having to deal with them on his flank, and he's going to be outnumbered, and the Prussians are going to do a great job there. And of course, do we ever hear about the Prussians in the British books?
They were there.
And yes, we shook hands with them. Thank you very much. So Napoleon takes the rest of his army up the road to Brussels, and Wellington is deployed here. John Elting, who's was a dear friend, a colonel in the army, which served in the 2nd Armored Division of World War II and taught at West Point. Also, you may know his name, Elting, because Elting and Esposito did all those West Point atlases, all those books with the maps. So that John Elting. He was at a dinner with the 8th Duke of Wellington, the descendant of the 1st Duke of Wellington. And the Duke of Wellington asked John Elting, he says, well, you know, if the Prussians couldn't show up, you know, if they said, hey, we just can't guarantee we're going to be there, he says, do you think Wellington would have still won the Battle of Waterloo? And Elting said, they wouldn't have been at Waterloo. If that army's not coming, okay, it's like Wellington's like, goodbye, good luck, we're going way over here to Austin, right over here, and we're getting on ships, and we're going away, okay? Because I'm not fighting Napoleon's army by myself, okay? Because I don't have an army the size of yours. My army is not all British. There's not all, very few veterans of the Peninsular War here, because where are all the veterans? Where's the best troops the British have in 1815?
On the way back from New Orleans.
Oh, that's right. A bunch of pirates and American frontiersmen are kicking the crap out of them in New Orleans, right? In the back of Pakenham, who is one of his best generals, who thinks that these Americans are a joke, right? It's like, oops, he's going to get killed by those joke soldiers, okay? But they're not bad. The bottom line is all these great troops, a lot of these great officers, and the men that Wellington can trust are either in America or slowly coming back from America, even though there's been a treaty signed. They're not coming back instantly, right? So that's why they're not there. So Wellington's got a lot of Dutch Belgians. He's got lots of Brunswickers, Hanoverians, and Nassauers, and a whole bunch of other small German states. And he has to rely on the Prussians to show up, and he's trusting that they're going to do it. That's a huge gamble on Wellington's part, because even if Blücher said, and he did, I will get here, things happen. Remember I told you about those corps that don't show up? All the Prussians have to be is late by an hour, 2 hours, and it's over. So Wellington is taking a huge gamble. All right, so around noon, before the French do their big attack, Napoleon assembles his army. There's Hougomont. Here's La Haye Sainte. You can see that I don't know if you can see the colors clearly, but the deep red are the British, and then you've got the Brunswickers in black. You've got the Dutch Belgians here. But you notice, why is there a division all the way over here? Brussels is up here, and the Prussians are coming from this direction. So why would you be worried about this side? That's because if you're going to retreat, remember where is Wellington thinking he's going to retreat? Yes, get on the ships, right? No ships in Brussels. They're all over here, which is also why he has that big force over here in Hull to make sure that that doesn't get cut off. He doesn't want his army to be cut off from the ports, because he can't support his army if he doesn't have the Royal Navy. So that's why this is so important. If this all goes pear-shaped, this whole unit, if he can keep it organized enough, is going to go this way, not this way to Brussels. It's like Brussels doesn't mean anything, and we don't really have to hold Brussels. Okay, between 4 and 6 p.m., this is where you have the cavalry of the French are going to make the British, you can see them all go into square, right? They're going to go over here, and they're going to try and break these troops. Now, why did this happen? A lot of people criticize Ney, saying, that's crazy, why do that? The Hanoverians are also wearing red jackets, so their troops look just like British troops from a distance. Hanoverians don't fight a lot. In fact, they haven't fought a lot. In fact, they've never been in a campaign. These are all green troops. So what happens to the Hanoverians is, as soon as they get one taste of this battle of warfare, a lot of them decide, thank you very much, I thought that was interesting, but I think I'll leave today, okay? So you have thousands of these Hanoverians like leaving the ranks and pouring back to Brussels, okay? What does that look like to the French? That's right, it does, doesn't it? And they're in red jackets, okay? In fact, one of the Prussians who comes up here on the flank, and he looks over here at this area in the rear, he noticed like so many guys retreating, he says, damn, we're too late. They're broken. They're done. So if the Prussians think this, and Ney is going to think, oh my God, we need the cavalry up here to
pursue.
Bingo, right? So that's why the cavalry comes up. What they run into is the solid line of squares, which don't break. Yeah, okay? So that's right. And they're riding around like, okay, now what, right? And this lasts a while, and then they come back, and they basically come back. Not much damage being done either way, okay? It's just it burns up time. Now, you may wonder, where's Napoleon? Where is he? Ney's running things up there, but what's happened? So I was curious myself, because some of the excuses that were written after the battle about why Napoleon, just he wasn't up to his speed, he was sick, he's old, you know, et cetera, so whatever is wrong, he's just not engaged. Okay, what if you know, and he did, he knew Prussians were coming out here on his flank. You see this? Where is Napoleon? What's the most dangerous part of the field from the French standpoint?
The right flank.
He is over there personally directing the defense to make sure that the things don't collapse. Ney can handle this. It's like, I mean, seriously, what are you up against, right? Just don't screw it up. I mean, he can recover from using the cavalry, because the cavalry's not destroyed. It's just like, you know, tired now, has to rest. But Napoleon is over here. This is very interesting. I'm gonna rush ahead just to tell you something so you understand how important this is. So down here is a town, Plancenoit, where the Prussians are going to break through. And then up here at the end is where the guard's going to attack, fail, and then Wellington is going to do a counterattack. So you have the counterattack coming this way. You have Plancenoit, the Prussians finally breaking through this way. And the French, in general, are going to lose anywhere from 50 to 70% of their troops, killed, wounded, and missing, because it's a big rout, it's going to fail, right? 15%. That's everything. 15%. It's like, wait a minute. These guys are between this one and this attack. How did they get out? and how they lose so few people. Who is directing them? Okay, when the Prussians first attack, why do they go down here? Because who do they run into? Bang. Right. Doesn't go anywhere, right? They're hammered. They're hammered. That's the end of that for several hours. So Napoleon will eventually come over here for the final attack to watch it, okay? Because he figures Ney's got things under control. So Lobau's 6th Corps of 2 Division basically going to march out, march back, and stay perfectly organized, lose only 15% of their men. And I was wondering, how can that happen? I was talking with Frank Chadwick about this. I said, how is that possible? The entire rest of the army is like getting hammered, anywhere from, 50, 60, 70% of its troops killed, wounded, and missing. How is it they get out? And he said, okay, you're the guys trying to chase them. You're attacking. You can go after these guys who are disorganized, running like crazy, and throwing away their weapons, or you can go after this group, which is well-organized, marching properly, and still dangerous. Okay? Which one do you want to chase? Okay? It's like, bye, have a nice day, right? See you sometime in the future. Okay, so even in defeat, armies don't lose exactly the same number of guys across the board. It depends on where they are on the battlefield and what condition they are. So that's what's going to happen.
I have a question about this slide.
Yes.
Was the French artillery able to be effective against the British squares once they formed squares?
Yes and no. The Grand Battery, which was formed up here, Napoleon decided all of it's going to be on the right, and he does hammer the line here, which then moves back behind the... there's a crest of the hill, and they go on the reverse slope, so they're protected. You can't see them. But even then, they have to pull back further because the artillery fire coming over the hill is still landing in their squares and their lines, okay? And I wondered, how can they do this? There's no indirect fire in the Napoleonic Wars. Wrong. It's like, what? There's no indirect... So when I was back at Carlisle Barracks, where they have the Army War College, okay, and they have a lot of training back there, up on their shelf is this book from 1814. It's the Guard Artillery Manual in French. It's like, why don't you guys do this? It's not up on their shelves. It's just sitting there. I said, ooh, I want to copy this. So guess one of the things that's in there is about... indirect fire. Okay, Napoleonic indirect fire. No, they're not sitting there, up 30, left. They don't do that, okay? There's a system that they've got that allows them to basically fire in the right direction and know how where people are that they're dropping the rounds onto. Yeah, it's blind fire, but it's pretty effective. So much so that Wellington orders these guys to move back, okay? And so the Grand Battery does its job in the fact that number one is that, they're not going to attack that side, okay? And the guns are pretty effective until they start running low on ammo. Remember, these guys are just shooting like crazy, okay? And even with the wet ground, because the ground comes down and it buries itself in the mud, okay? It doesn't skip. What happens is you hit enough. If guns are firing hundreds of rounds, eventually one or two are going to hit in where you want them to. And there was an account of a British unit that said one round killed or wounded 20 guys. That's how effective. Imagine if they'd been able to see these guys. Well, we actually have an example of that. Because, as I said, this Grand Battery did not do as much as Napoleon was hoping. But here's what did happen. At the end of the battle, after they took La Haye Sainte, okay, after the French captured it, what happened is... All the reserves come forward. This is when they do the attack with the guard. But right here behind La Haye Sainte, there's nobody there. There's nothing behind. This is it. They bring up the 28th Foot. Okay, the 28th Foot had not been in the battle up until this point. So within basically an hour, and these are the British records now I'm looking at, the 28th Foot loses 82% of its men killed and wounded. How'd that happen so fast? Napoleon sends forward his guard artillery, the best of the best, and he's an artilleryman. So they come up, they're just out of range of this unit, and what do they do to the square? Oh, it's done. And this is probably not an hour. We're talking about as fast as these guys can fire. This unit loses. That's just after the fact. We don't know how many guys, took off or carried their friends away that were wounded, right? But if there were guys still with the flag, okay, they're still standing there with the king's colors, but they may be inside another square by that point, because they were just wiped out. This is one of those classic DLMs, okay? It's gone. It's, yes?
I heard that, was it Blizzet, the Dutch commander, the Dutch Belgian commander?
Byland, yes?
Yeah, he got pretty well slaughtered by the artillery.
Oh, yes, his unit loses. One of his battalions loses 82%, his unit overall, because what happened at the beginning? Let me go back just one, because you were asking, did they do anything? Okay, so the Grand Battery is here. Here's La Haye Sainte. There's the line behind the ridge. Their position in front of the ridge, that brigade, is he an idiot? Wait a minute. Who places all the units on the field before the battle?
Well,
oops. Okay, and then he badmouths them after the battle for being too far forward. It's like, wait a minute, who put them there? So that brigade gets annihilated by the Grand Battery. So yes, they did do things, but what Napoleon was hoping to do, or just break the whole line, did not happen. Okay, so the last attack of the guard comes up. Had they gone to this side of La Haye Sainte instead of this side of La Haye Sainte, they would have run into really weak units and would have broken through. But one of the things that I think is really important about this campaign is that, and if you look at the overall losses after the French retreat, is, look at the number of British, 35% losses overall. This never happened in the peninsula. They lost more colors at Waterloo, one battle, than they lost in 8 years in the peninsula, okay? So you can see that the loss rate is huge for the Allies. And I'm going to say two quick things because we're running out of time. One is that Napoleon could have gone for a draw that day. Could have said, you know what, we're not going to try and risk losing it. We're going to use the guard instead of this last assault. We're going to stop the Prussians on our right. And what we're going to do is we're going to fight the next day, because I still have basically fresh troops that I can bring up. And Grouchy is behind the Prussians. They can't get more supplies. And Wellington's army is pretty much trashed. Okay, had he gone for a second day battle, 2 day battle, he probably would have won. But had he won the battle, people are still saying he's not going to win the campaign. All he has to do is survive, and this is why. Back in April, you probably have seen the explosions of the volcanoes in Sumatra and Malaysia and all that thing that you do today. And you probably have heard of Krakatoa east of Java, probably that thing. Okay, well, before that, the same area, Tambora, blew up in 1815. Okay? So the next year, 1816, was called the year without a summer. There was so much ash and trash in the sky from this explosion in Malaya that what happened is there was no crops the next year. So most people were using their armies to control riots and the people, which means had Napoleon survived the campaign, he didn't have to win the whole thing. All he had to do was survive. The next year, no one's going to be campaigning anywhere because they can't even support their people back home, let alone the armies in the field. So that also is not brought up. But there you go. Thank you very much. That's the end of my talk. We only have time for a couple of questions, but what I'd like to do is also mention I have some giveaways. I have some freebies. So if you stay long enough, that always stands on the table. I like to give away stuff. Okay, so questions. Yes?
Do you think Wellington's experience in the peninsula influenced his deployment, as well as the fact, the Prussians were either at Liège or Namur, but they held that crossroads, and they didn't have to deal with unhappy populace. The key to Wellington's victory in the peninsula is the fact that the Spanish partidas, the peninsula, were picking off 300 French a day.
Right.
So was his experience in the peninsula, was he overly sensitive from that and had that very deep deployment?
He was in enemy country. Belgium was not an independent country. Belgium had been a province of France. Right. Most of his people had served in the French army, not in Belgian units, but just had been in different French units because they didn't do it that way. So anywhere in France, from the same town, you might have guys in a cavalry unit and this regiment and that regiment and so forth. Same thing happened in Belgium. There was at least one incident where a cavalry unit of Belgians basically, charged the French and just said, hey guys, how you doing? And that's it, and just rode off. So he was dealing with an army that was questionable in territory that was actually potentially hostile. And yes, I think that he recognized the French had to deal with partisans behind the lines, and he couldn't afford to have his couriers and his supply trains picked off. So that's, yes, I think that that influenced his, the way that he occupied Belgium, which again, like, it wasn't Belgium as a country yet. Yes?
Grouchet was a cavalry commander, right?
Yes.
And he was mostly infantry. And I've heard that one of the problems he had is the infantry officers were like, you're an idiot, you know, we're not, you don't know what you're talking about. We need to go to the sound of the guns.
Which never happens today in modern, you know.
Yeah.
I'm sure that the Army loves following the orders of Air Force guys and things like that. So it never happens. Right. Yes, absolutely, Roger. Yes. Sure. Grouchy comes up and is telling guys, you know, what to do. And they're thinking, this guy doesn't know crap about, you know, the horses or the infantry or whatever it is. And yes, remember, it's a learning exercise. So he has to prove himself to the guys who are under him. Right?
Yeah.
And that, yeah, this campaign... It's supposed to be the last battle. He knows he still has to fight the Russians. He still may have to fight the Austrians. So what he's trying to do is get these guys up to speed, Soult, Grouchy, and all these guys, because he doesn't have anybody else to work with. Berthier is gone, right? Davout's back at Paris. I got to use what I've got, right? So if they make mistakes, they make mistakes.
Yeah.
Any other questions? No, you're all waiting for the freebies, I know.
Basically, why did Luther really lose this war to...
Okay.
Really quick.
No problem. Okay, so the Prussians arriving in the numbers they did, as quickly as they did, and able to stage those attacks on his flank, first pulled a lot of his troops over that he had to deal with instead of concentrating on Wellington. And eventually they were going to break through. It's just weight of numbers. He couldn't fight both of them. If he had decided, you know what, I'm just going to wait... I'm going to stop them because it's getting dark, right? And go for the next day. He could have brought up fresh troops along with Lobau's corps, which hasn't been hammered, right? And he actually has more supplies and replacements coming up the road. Wellington has no more people showing up, okay? The Prussians are far away from their supplies. Had he done a two-day battle, I think he would have won. But he went, I think a lot of it was he was trusting Ney's judgment that the British were about to break, which is why he had the guard make that last attack. When they failed to break through, and they just weren't enough of them, they were just outnumbered, and Wellington then countercharged, it was almost simultaneously with that the Prussians broke through at Plancenoit. That's where the reinforcements needed to go. Had they gone down there and stopped the Prussians, Wellington's not making that attack. The only reason he did is because he sensed that with the repulse of the guard, he had an advantage that he wanted to take advantage of. Yes?
Well, you were talking about earlier with the Prussian officers were all aristocrats and so on, and so just were not good.
Right.
Well, the British Army was on the purchase system at the time for officers, and not every one of them was a crack soldier.
So no. Napoleon had a very low opinion of these other armies and everything, but
Wellington's a product of the purchase system.
Right, but he was the best they had. Okay? He was absolutely the best.
All those years in India.
And he had beaten everybody except Napoleon.
Foreign secretary.
The only time he faced Napoleon, he defeated him here. Okay? Technically, he didn't face Napoleon. You know what I mean? It's like Ney is the one who's actually running things. Had Napoleon flipped that over and said, Ney, you keep the Prussians off of us, and I'll deal with Wellington, who knows what would have happened, right?
That's why we play the games.
That's why you play the games. Okay.
Well, but Wellington does have, you know, he's got several of his generals that had been campaigning with him only the year before for 6 years
right.
on the peninsula.
Right.
I mean, he has Picton, who dies,
mm-hmm.
But he has Hill,
mm-hmm.
who remains with the observation corps.
Why does he have him back there instead of right up front with him? Because if it goes pear-shaped, you need someone reliable to make sure the army doesn't get totally destroyed.
Well, you know, even though the guard was beaten, you know, at Waterloo, right. They right. still were not so beaten that they weren't able to do a 32-day rear guard action
all the way to Paris. That's right.
That covered Napoleon's
yes.
retreat back
yes.
to Paris.
Exactly.
You know, if Napoleon had just signed an order to dissolve the French Parliament
right.
and had De Gaulle enforce it,
yep.
then there would have been no legal mechanism to depose him.
That's right.
And then the whole Tambora scenario comes into play.
That's right.
Also.
That's right. And even losing the battle, he could have stayed emperor. He could have remained emperor. Yes. Okay. Any other questions before we get to the handouts?
Nope. Handouts.
Okay. All right. Two things. One is that on September 19th, I'm helping host a free event at San Jose State University called First Air War. You know, Snoopy and the Red Baron. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's all about World War I aviation, but it's also reflecting how that had an impact on everything that all the way up to drones today. Okay, there are several seminars going on, but there's also going to be exhibit hall with games, with artifacts, with art, a lot of things to shop for and take a look at, and it's at the Student Union at San Jose State University. I happen to have free tickets to this event. Okay, I also have some very... even more rare, open seating for the seminars, free. So if you're really, really interested in the seminars, I'll give you this ticket because it gets you into everything. And if you just want to go ahead and take off, the, you know, look at the exhibits and so forth, or you know somebody who is interested, I'll give you one or several tickets, whatever you want, okay? Who would like the just free admission tickets versus the seminar tickets? Who wants seminar? Seminar, okay. One?
Please.
Who else? One?
One for two for me, one for me. Myself.
Absolutely. Two? One?
Two.
There you go. Okay. Anybody else? All right. Anybody want just the free admission tickets just to get in? To walk around?
How much are they usually if I pay?
Okay, so there's limited seating. It is free. But the thing is, I'm giving you tickets so that you can absolutely get in.
Oh, okay.
Because what will happen, you can't just wander in and sit down in the theater because there's only so many seats. So you have to sign up for those tickets, okay, even though it's free. All right. Anybody? All right. Okay, so here's what we do. I do a quick trivia test to give away stuff. All right? So, let's see. Why don't we do... Here's a great Napoleonic t-shirt with one of the most important tanks Napoleon had. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, well, are you going to have one with that short stuff with Gettysburg?
Yes. Okay, so it's an XL, which, you know, fits me easily. So what we'll do is I'm going to ask what did not show up at the Battle of Ligny?
Anybody?
Fourth Corps.
Darylon's First Corps.
He got both. He said the First Corps and the Fourth Corps.
Yay!
So, congratulations.
Yay!
Okay. So semi-related to Napoleonics is the American Civil War. I helped put together this with John Hill. It's a guidebook to the Battle of Bull Run. And they sold this at the Battlefield Park for a long time until they came out with something of their own. But it's mostly just maps and order of battle. Oh, yeah. Nice for Wargamers. So I have two of these. So let me do the next trivia question. What was the main reason I gave why Napoleon could have won the Battle of Waterloo? It wasn't predestined that he was going to lose. What was it?
The second day.
No, you can't do it now. You can't. You won.
Oh, you're exempt.
Yes, you can't do it. You can't get more. Don't worry. What was one of my main arguments that I presented why Napoleon had a chance to win that Battle of Waterloo?
You brought up the example of Ligny.
He already won a battle.
Fought a bigger army
yep.
in less time
yep.
and still beat them.
2 days before. That's right. If he can beat them, he can certainly beat Wellington a couple days later. Okay, so the next trivia question is Napoleon, this is a question about organization. What other advantage did Napoleon have? You know, there's an artilleryman. What did he do besides just having more cavalry, for example, at Ligny, that made it possible for him to be more effective with that?
He massed them as corps instead of just breaking up those.
There you go. That's right.
Wow.
Put them together in major formations.
And we have a winner.
Excellent. Woo! All right. I'm going to do my next talk after a quick break. You know what? Everyone's a winner because I have these. Are you familiar with Against the Odds magazine? Okay, so they do a whole series of these little micro games that are on postcards.